Well, hello, Village Church. Pastor Mark here. Glad you are with us, man. What a year it's been. We're already through January and we're through John chapter 1. I mean, we're just ripping fast. I saw someone the other day on social media going, it only took like 2 months to get through one chapter. What, are you in a hurry? And I'm like, what's up? Let's do it. So this is exciting. Get your Bibles out, John chapter 2. We're going to do something a little bit different today. We're going to do communion as we land the plane today. And so we have kind of been telling you on social media, but if you missed it, go pause me if you can right now, or if not, just go to the kitchen, grab some wine, grab some juice, whatever your situation is, get some bread, bring it to the table, rip it up a little, have it in front of you, because in about 35, 40 minutes, however long I go here, we never know, we're gonna land this moment where we're worshiping in regard to the text. We've worshiped by singing. Now we're worshiping by entering into the study of the Bible. And I want to get us focused on Jesus, and then I want to worship by taking communion. Now, another part of worship, of course, is giving. And so here we are in February. Hopefully you are giving. The easiest way to do it, obviously, during this COVID moment is to give online and also to do reoccurring giving. That's the best way where we can plan. We actually propped up our budget by almost $1 million this past year. So it's about a $9 million budget this year because we have so much ministry stuff that we want to do. We want to hire great staff to be able to do it, to serve you and love you well, expand, but also fortify and do the things we're already doing and do them better. But also we got some awesome things in the works. So if you haven't, this is villagechurch.com/give is the place to go. You can see that link here. Go there, sign up for reoccurring giving. It just helps us be able to plan and know that that money's coming in so we can do ministry well. I was just talking to one of our pastors and he said that the stuff that our pastors and leaders are dealing with in regard to shepherding people is incredible. He said, even the Canada Helpline, if you compare the numbers from 2019, there was about 1.7 million calls that they dealt with. In 2020, it was like 4.9 million calls. People are struggling. I know you're struggling. You're inside. There's depression on the rise. There's pain. There's isolation. We get it, which is why the church needs to be the church well. We need to shepherd well, pastor well, lead well, inspire well, serve well. And so that's what we want to do in 2021. And we're hopeful that we're going to be able to gather as a church. Hopefully maybe by the fall we can do that. That's what we're shooting for, aiming for. But who knows where the COVID thing goes. We're praying. We're hoping that Jesus is going to do some cool stuff. So here we go. John chapter 2. Now we move. John's gospel, very interestingly, is like a little treasure hunt. So now we're through chapter 1. He's introduced us to some of the main characters. We're going to get more characters as we go, but it's such a great story because it's like John has all these like symbols within symbols that it's like a cryptic little, it's like, you know, you remember the treasure hunts you did as a kid? Like you'd go around looking for little eggs or whatever, little digging up the little gold things. It literally, if you're looking for it, once you see it in the Gospel of John, you begin to realize the stuff he does, the cryptic realities, the hidden little things, the symbols, the ideas you have to track and trace down. It's like reading the Da Vinci Code or something. Like, oh, you're in Paris and you're looking at a painting and then you're going under a statue and then you see this and you got to find the eye. It's incredible. It's just a page turner if you know what you're looking for. And so what we begin to realize is every word, every phrase, it's a symbol. And he's trying to always do something with it and move it along. And we're going to see that he does that in amazing. This is what John does in incredible ways. I saw a meme the other day and it was like it was two guys in a car. One of them was like in total, like normal attire, just wearing like a suit and just normal. And over it said Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then beside him is this guy like wearing full on pink boas and big glasses. And he's just like having a huge party. I think it was Elton John or something. And then it said the Gospel of John. All right. Like that's literally these two beside each other. You go Matthew, Mark, Luke, what are called the synoptics. And then you have John. It's just a different game and it's unbelievable. And we start to see it now in John 2, where he gives us this story. That's one of the most famous stories ever told. It's religious or not religious. The turning of water into wine. It's going to take us 2 weeks to get through it. Because there's so much in it that we've got to actually delve into. So it says a lot about Jesus, but it also says a lot about us. And we're going to see it's hidden, some of the stuff that we're going to pull out. But then once you know it's there, it's so clear and you can't unsee it, right? It's like I'm in like the Les Miserables mode right now. So I'm like watching it and listening to the on stage album just over and over and over again, the 10th anniversary version of it. It's just brilliant. The greatest musical of all time is Les Mis. And it's like, And I'm listening to it, and I realized one of the first times I ever saw it was I had read like an article about it that said something about how it's a very biblical story around law versus grace. And once I saw it, right from the beginning, you see, I am Javert, you will pay a price, 24601. You know, you have like this, that character, Inspector Javert, is like, he's law. And he is going to make Jean Valjean pay for everything. And Jean Valjean's like, I stole some bread, what should I do? And he's like, I will track you down your whole life. You know, and it's like, and then he goes away, he steals some stuff from the priest, and the priest brings him in. This how you are my brother, ooh, doo, 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 and you shall now go in peace. You know, and you have this moment of grace, and the rest of the story is Javert representing law. You will pay. If you broke the law one time, you pay for your life, and I'm going to track you down for 20 years to make sure you pay. And then you have Jean Valjean in this entire world of grace, making sure the prostitute gets what she doesn't get, making sure that he doesn't, something that they don't deserve. And you realize that's the entire story. It's a story about law versus grace. It's the book of Galatians. See, now, what was the point of me saying all that? Because the minute you see it, you can't unsee it. The minute you understand that about the musical, you can't unsee, it's gospel. It's a gospel story about how gospel breaks apart law and enters into a new epoch, a new era, a new world. That is what John chapter 2 is. It's the beginning of the breaking in of a new world and the ending of the old, the way of law. And Jesus presents a new reality. So here we go. Let's go. John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day. So we have this image. He's about to go to a wedding. There was a wedding. And so what it's trying to tell us is that weddings in Jewish culture tended to be on Tuesdays or Wednesdays. So the first day of the week was Sunday. So they tend to be on Tuesday, Wednesday, so that you wouldn't break into any Sabbath problems. So you have this wedding going on at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. So we have this wedding, and it's beautiful that the first sign that Jesus is going to do, if you look down to verse 11 of the story, it says this, meaning the miracle that he did, which we'll get to this week and next week, the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee. So what do you mean signs? He's saying that Jesus did these particular things that were to be interpreted what was going on in his life by the world. He did signs, he pointers. And so they weren't magic tricks. They were pointers to something he wanted to say about God and himself. And so here's Jesus sitting at a wedding. He's done nothing to do his big revelation yet. He's God. He's the Messiah. He's the anointed one. He knows what he wants to bring on the world. He's going to reveal his kind of coming into the world, and he hasn't done anything yet. And he's now, what's the setting? He's at a wedding. Now, you and I, as you know, first century or 21st century people, we just kind of miss this. We're like, I don't know, he's at a wedding. Who cares? John, everything matters. Here's what we got to understand. A first century Jew would not have missed this. You see, the Old Testament had this expectation of the Messianic age would be the age when Israel was here and the bridegroom would show up. Okay, it was like the Messiah was the groom of Israel, and he would come for her one day, and there would be a Messianic banquet, like a feast, like a wedding. Even today in Christian language, how does the New Testament end? Revelation 19, when Jesus, the groom, comes back for his bride, the church, he brings her to a marriage supper of the Lamb. That's how the whole Bible ends, Revelation chapter 19. This is what the image is. It's all about wedding. The Bible started with a wedding. Remember that Adam and Eve? They're in the garden, and God does their wedding ceremony, and he reads them a poem about all of this amazing stuff. It begins with a wedding, and it ends with a wedding. And in between, you have a million weddings, micro weddings of human beings in the world. And every single one of them represents the gospel. Every single one of them represents the covenant relationship of God and his people to such a point I can almost guarantee you, here's the crazy thing. So go to, if you go to about Ephesians chapter 5, if you don't, I'll show it to you here. Listen to this text, the crazy text. Paul's explaining what to do in the context of marriage. And he says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, okay, leave, and hold fast to his wife. So cleave. So you got a man and you got a wife and you got the father and mother, these characters. You got to leave and cleave. Some of you, you need to hear that message today in regard to your marriages. You haven't left mama yet, all right? You're still hoping she makes you peanut butter sandwiches. You got to get a life, right? You got to leave. Notice it says just to the man, actually, that, like, because men tend to have a hard time getting off, you know, the easy world that they lived in when all their clothes would be done for them and, you know, whatever. You got to leave, and then you got to cleave to your wife, and the two shall become one flesh. It's a very beautiful image. But then Paul says something weird. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. What are you referring to Christ and the church? Meaning this thing I just quoted from Genesis about leaving and cleaving, that is actually an image about Christ and the church. Well, when, Paul, did Christ leave his father and come down to grab a hold of his wife? Oh, wait, that's the incarnation. That's Jesus Christ leaving heaven and coming down. Do we ever pitch the gospel as the story of the king, the prince, who goes on the adventure and gives his own life to save his damsel in distress, to save his queen, to go? That is literally what the gospel story is. And so here, we have the picture of a wedding, the great moment. And here he is at a wedding at Cana. Now, let's talk about weddings back then. Because we got to understand the setting before we get to just jumping to the wine, right? We just tend to jump to the wine. We're like, when's Jesus going to turn the water into wine? He's at a wedding. Here's the setting of a wedding. In Jewish law, what you would do is you would have your wedding in the evening, and it was a feast. And then all your homies, like if you were a guy, all your homies would come to her house. They would get her with you. And the two of you would be traipsed along the village, and you'd have a canopy over you and by torchlight, and the whole village would be partying. You'd have a feast at night, and then you'd go and you'd consummate, ding, ding. And then for like 6 days to 7 days, it was a party. Now, to a peasant poor culture, weddings were like the celebration. It was the one time when you're grinding away for 10 hours a day in the field and you get to stop and enjoy your buddies. You know, it was the whole village would come together and they'd party for 7 straight days and you were treated like kings and queens. That's the setting, right? So here you are. Remember your wedding? Like it wasn't half of that. Like my wedding, like built up to it, like had the wedding, and then like, you know, you leave, you go do your thing. It's like, you know, you don't want to be around your village. You go on a honeymoon. Like Aaron's parents were like, hey, like on your wedding night, you want to like stay at the house? We're like, no, I don't want to see you in the morning. What are you talking about? It's weird, man. So, but you would do that. You would stay there. You'd have the celebration. The whole village would come together. People would celebrate, treat you like kings. And then what happens? Here's this wedding, this beautiful setting in a culture where all of this is all that matters at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. So Jesus' mother gets invited. I love that, by the way. He calls her the mother of Jesus, the mother of Jesus. Like he's just framing who she is for us rather than just saying, you know, Jesus was so divine that he didn't have any human relations. He's going, no, he had a mom. You ever thought, like, do you ever think about that Jesus had a mother and the fact that other gospels tell us he had brothers and sisters? So Jesus was the oldest brother of a family. He had brothers and sisters, and he has a mother. And, like, we don't really think about that often, the relationship between Jesus and his mother. But here he was at a wedding with his mom, maybe sitting with her, maybe sitting off, whatever. Jesus also was invited, that's nice, to the wedding with his disciples. So now he's got like a handful of these disciples. And it's kind of an awkward conversation because it's like, hey, I got all these new friends. I'm supposed to go to this wedding on Tuesday. Can they come? And it's like, yes. Like, do you have room for this? You know? So Jesus comes with his disciples. And then Here's the big tragedy. When the wine ran out, this is a massive problem. All right, because here's what we think about. We read that and we're like, yeah, what's the big deal? The wine ran out. Do you want a soda? All right, that's what we would do at our, like, come over to my house, the wine runs out, I'll crack you a Perrier. That tends not to be what happens here, but not because they're stuffy, because weddings like this, you got to understand, in a shame culture, the seriousness of the humiliation of running out of wine during a wedding was a massive problem in regard to a shame culture. I was invited to a wedding a few years ago. I had done this beautiful couple. I had done their wedding. And then they had a dinner. And what had happened was, is I was so tired, I had to preach the next morning because a lot of weddings are on Saturdays and I still had to do my work and all this stuff. And so I had kind of forgot to tell them that I wasn't going to be coming to the reception. And so we did the wedding. You know, my wife and I had been invited to the reception like months earlier. We had said yes. I had completely forgot about that. And I get home, and later that night, the people who were sitting at our table took a kind of a selfie with the whole table and my wife and I's, you know, plate of food sitting there untouched. And they just kind of texted me like, ah, and I kind of, ah, because I'm like, whatever. And then my wife saw the picture. Well, it was over. Like, I'm not sure she talked to me for 2 days because it was embarrassing for her. How can you be invited to a wedding, make people pay $80 a plate for you to be there, and you're a no-show, bro? You did the wedding. Like, you're the worst human being on the planet. You see, there was humiliation even in our culture around weddings. To them, there's people in the Middle East who take their own life based on the shame that comes from this stuff. Now, here's and all the commentaries. I read about probably 13 commentaries for every passage that we go through in a series like this. And every commentary talked about the idea, made this point. What we miss is a wedding, a marriage was not, it wasn't a social outing. It was a legal obligation. When you gave your daughter to, like, I got three daughters. You better, whoever marries those three daughters, it's going to be more than it's a legal obligation. Like back in Genesis, you would like, here's your daughter, but I need 12, you know, cows or 8 goats or whatever. Like, it was just like a legal trade. And for you to run out of wine means you're not holding up your end of the bargain, which meant, according to Levitical law, check this, I can take you to court and sue you and put you into financial debt. So when we read this story, knowing all that background, now it starts to make sense why this is a big deal. Why Jesus is going to save this couple. It ain't because he just wants another glass and they ran out. What he's doing, one scholar has says, quote, is rescuing a young couple from a financial liability that would have crippled them economically for years, which is why the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. We're like, no big deal. This young couple and their family may go into crippling debt for many years ahead. Now, can I pull out of this something for us? I love how Jesus cares about the small, normal things. This situation, though, it's pretty rough. It's like, it's not like God only cares about the stuff that sounds really meaningful. Like this isn't about like salvation. See, sometimes we think Jesus only cares about salvation and heaven and hell and your concept of God and your discipleship. We don't realize Jesus cares about your wedding and your money and the stress around your debt. And you raising the kids and the parties of your life and your home and your relationships that they're going well. Like he cares about those things. He's in the weeds of our lives. That's the beautiful thing. He's in the weeds. When I lived in Ontario and I started trying to discern what I was going to do with my life, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to go into film school. I don't know. I was working at Michael's Arts and Crafts store and trying to figure out what to do with my life, dating Erin. I don't know how she held on to me. made $6.85 an hour, and I would just spend it on cigarettes and gas. That was it. That's all I needed it for. I didn't have any other, you know, dreams in life. I was trying to figure out what to do. And then I remember standing at Michael's, and I was putting some googly eyes away. And all of a sudden, it was a Friday night, and this almost palpable feeling came over me, and I started breathing, and I started crying, and I don't cry. I started crying and shaking, and I called Aaron on the cell phone. There was no text back then, and any kid under 20 right now is like, well, I don't understand. What do you mean there's no text back then? What is this, horse and buggy? So I call her up saying, come meet me in the parking lot. She comes to meet me in the parking lot. I'm like, I don't know what's going on. I have this, and she's like, let's pray. We started praying. All of a sudden, I was like, hey, are you feeling like this sense about something to do with like school? I'm like, yeah, it's like there's like, and then it became clear. It was like, oh yeah, I get the sense I'm supposed to go to Bible college. And then we're like, no, we won't do that. And so then I go on weeks and weeks, and then I go away to a friend's house. And her dad brings me down in the basement, and we start talking a little bit. He goes, can I pray for you? I'm like, yeah. And he starts to pray for me. And all of a sudden, I had mentioned nothing. All of a sudden, he starts going, I feel like the Lord's telling me you're supposed to go to Bible college. You're supposed to go study the Bible. You're supposed to become a pastor. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I want to go to film school. I want to go into that. No, not going to do it. 2 weeks later, I go away with three of my buddies. We're sitting around the fire. All three of them start to go, the Spirit's telling me you're supposed to go. This is like the Lord, like, hey, wake up. And so we went and did that. And then I was like, what do I do next? I've done Bible college. Someone walks up to me, one of the teachers, I'm like, you're supposed to move out to British Columbia and go do more studies. This pastor came around, doesn't even know her. Hey, I think you're supposed to move to Vancouver. And so then Aaron and I are like, well, are we gonna move to Vancouver when we get married? This is crazy. Well, let's try to figure out. And then just random stuff started to happen. You know, you just meet someone, they're like, hello, my name's Vancouver. Nice to meet you, or whatever, right? It's like, what is happening? See, all of this became so clear because Jesus cares about the little stuff. Some of you right now, you think it's too small to pray about. It's too small to care. He's not going to care about it. I had a friend, they were looking at a house recently, and they were waiting to hear back whether they were going to get it. And she said, I started to pray, and then I thought, oh, it's too small a thing to pray about. And so I stopped. And then the Lord pressed on me and goes, what are you talking about? This is your life. This is the stuff I care about if you care about it. This is what I'm saying. This is what Jesus, he's in the wedding. And there's debt to be had, and there's fun to be had, and there's celebration to be had, and he cares about it. And so he does this amazing, here's Mary turning to Jesus. Look at the other half of verse 3. The mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. She comes to Jesus to deal with the problem. Listen to this, because for 30 years, she's been doing this. And every time he shows up, that's who we're talking about here. You need a hero in your life. Don't make it me because I'm on video. I'll totally let you down. I'm a wreck. Don't make it a cool celebrity pastor. Don't make it a religious leader. Jesus, because, you know, Joseph's probably dead. We don't know how long Joseph has been dead for, but he's totally out of the scene. He's not in the Gospels. So most likely he's been dead, maybe for many years. And Jesus has had to be Mary and him almost probably have like that familial, almost like husband-wife relationship, because it's like, you're the old son, you're gonna make the money, you're gonna take care of the family. I've been looking to you to solve problems like I would have Joseph, but he's gone. And Jesus just, he shows up every time. He's just dead, gets it done every time, and she knows that about him. And so there's this old tradition, it's an apocryphal tradition outside of the Bible, that means, but I find it fascinating. There's this legend of when Jesus was a little baby. There's all these like books written that nobody thinks are actually like historically accurate, and you know, but they tell stories about like Jesus' childhood, like he walks around with people and he's like, "You blockhead!" And they boom, turn them into a bird or whatever. And so no one actually thinks it's legit. But there's this one tradition where people in the village, when they would going through difficult times and they'd be going through stress, they would go over to Mary's house. And they would stare at her baby, and all the problems would go away. And this became legend. You look to Mary's child, Here's Jesus dealing with the problems. Now, this is the crazy part. Let's go one more level on that, because I want you to look to Jesus in the midst of your tensions too. She does that. Underline this. The mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." She does that even though she does not understand what Jesus is necessarily going to do. She doesn't, listen to me. Let me say that again. She doesn't know what Jesus is necessarily going to do. All she says is they have no wine. But she trusts him. Look at verse 4. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me?" I'll come back to this. His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." So she doesn't understand what he's going to do. But listen to me. She trusts him still. This might be one of the most definitive questions of our lives. Listen, even if you can't understand what Jesus is doing, do you trust him? Even if you don't understand why this is playing out the way it's playing out, do you trust that Jesus is gonna do the right thing? Just let that sink. This is a crazy idea, because when stuff hits the fan in life and the wine disappears, that make that a symbol for whatever is in, the diagnosis, the money runs out, the marriage is a disaster, your kids become teenagers, whatever. And things just look sketchy, and it might not be going down the way you thought it was going to go down. There are one of two things you can do. You can say, "I don't know why this is playing out the way it's playing out, but I trust Jesus that he's doing the right thing." Or you can say, "I don't know why my life is playing out the way it's playing out. I'm out. Screw this. I'm done. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in divine providence. I don't believe Jesus has me anymore." And that's the definitive question of your life. When the world looks like he doesn't have it, when your world looks like he doesn't have it, do you, like Mary, trust that he's going to do something and that it's going to be right? Now, we don't know, you look at my grandfather, for instance, he's 98 years old. At some point, probably, you know, he's going to pass away soon, probably. We can look at that and say, well, he's 98 years old. He had his time. Fair enough. But the book of Ecclesiastes says, whenever you die, it was your time. It doesn't feel right when you lose someone. But Jesus has it, even though on this side of the veil, it might not look like it. The wine has run out. The party's going to come to a close. What are you going to do? I either trust you or I don't trust you. Now think about this for all the people. Think about what keeps us from faith. Here's what I picture Jesus doing right now at this wedding. This is the image in my brain. This is not in the Bible, so just roll with me for a sec. Here's what I picture right now. He's chilling with all his buddies. Okay, the wedding's going. He's sitting there. He's got his disciples. They're all chatting, telling stories. And he has toothpick in his mouth. And he's sitting back on the chair and he's watching the wine run out and he's waiting and he knows things are going to get sketchy. His mom approaches him and he's sitting there and he's conjuring this in his mind. Look it up in verse 4. "My hour has not yet come." He's pondering in his mind, "I'm 30 years old. I know my ministry has to start soon. When am I going to start it? When am I going to do something that cracks the door open and tells the world there's something different about me?" Because to this point, it's been hidden in John's gospel. Nobody knows he's any different than any other first century Jew. And he's got his toothpick, and he's at a wedding, and he's saying, "Is this a cool spot? This is a wedding. There's a messianic banquet image here. I could pull out and do something to reveal something." Like, look at what John tells us. Once he turns the water into wine, if we ever get there the next 3 weeks, just this week and next, he manifested his glory. When am I going to manifest my glory? When's the first time I'm going to do something that's a sign to the world to tell them who I am and tell them what God's doing? When am I going to do it? So he's sitting there with his toothpick, chilling out. He's had a nice meal. And now this problem arises. Do you know, do you believe that Jesus is still in control when things look like they're sideways? Or do you look to him and go, I know it might look like you're just chilling right now, but you have a plan. And you actually are paying attention and you're about to do a new work. You're about to bring about life through this sketchy, weird scenario. And I gotta look for it. See, I would say, what keeps us from faith? What keeps us in that other camp that says, things are a mess, I don't want anything to do with God anymore? To be honest, I think sometimes it's that you don't want it. Now, here's what I mean. So remember, I'm going to show you the opening scene of a movie called The Prestige right now, okay? The Prestige. It's a movie about magic. Don't get distracted by all of it. Just listen to the narrative. In the first 2-3 minutes of the movie, what he says, because I think there's something profound in there for us. Watch this.
Are you watching closely?
Every magic trick consists of three parts, or acts. The first part is called the pledge. The magician shows you something ordinary, a deck of cards, a bird, or a man. He shows you this object. Perhaps he asks you to inspect it, to see that it is indeed real. Yeah, an order. Normal. But of course, it probably isn't.
Oh, you think you're going?
Oh, the bloody axe, you fool!
The second act is called the turn. The magician takes the ordinary something and makes it do something extraordinary. Now, you're looking for the secret, but you won't find it. Because, of course, you're not really looking. You don't really want to know. You want to be fooled. But you wouldn't clap yet, because making something disappear isn't enough. You have to bring it back. That's why every magic trick has a third act, the hardest part, the part we call the prestige.
You see what the narrative says? He says this. You aren't really looking. You don't really want to know. See, I think there's some instances where we get in tough spots in life. Think about the people, the trend of the de-churched, people who just, and it happens every generation. People leave the church. People go, oh, I don't like the church anymore, and they leave, and you know, all of that. Sometimes it's a rite of passage. It just happens. Sometimes there's legitimate reasons and churches do their best. Leaders do their best to make the decisions. And so, but sometimes it happens. I would say to those people who are leaving the church, oftentimes what's going on is it's almost like there's other scenarios in your life that make you not want to see what Jesus is actually, you don't want to take a closer look. You don't really want to see, because if you saw, then you'd see that he was calling you out of this or saying, live for me like this, or don't do this with relationships, or make sure you do this with work life, or make sure you do this with your vocation. And we don't really want that because we've got to a place where we want to do something else. And so it's not so much I'm going to leave. It's because Jesus, if you looked closely, if you paid attention, he'd start doing a thing and you'd rather stay on the side of, you know what? Things aren't going the way I want out. And so here's Jesus. He does then, I mean, psychologically, that's a whole fascinating world of being confronted by Jesus and choosing to go away from him rather than to embrace him. But we don't want to look too hard, even with this miracle. You see, Mary comes to Jesus with this interesting request. I mean, she doesn't actually even ask him to do anything. She just says they have no wine. Here's what I love about it. Jesus is doing little things in humble villages. He's what one scholar has called the domesticated God. He does ordinary things. But here we have someone just saying they have no wine. They don't even really know what to ask. Have you felt in your life like there are times where you don't even know how to relate to Jesus because you don't know how to ask? I was reading J.I. Packer the other day, and he said something profound that I think some of you need to hear right now. He says this: God fixes our prayers on the way up. If he does not answer the prayer we made, he will answer the prayer we should have made. This is all anyone needs to know. Think about that for your life. We're afraid to pray the wrong thing or seek after the thing from God, whatever. He's in this little scenario. One scholar put it this way. He said this, and I love this, because he's in this little town, right? He's in this wedding at Cana is the name. It's this little podunk, you know, town, and in the middle of nowhere. And I've actually been there before, and they have these big stone water pots that kind of commemorate this wedding, which I'll talk about next week. But you have this little town, and one writer talks about the idea that we have the domesticated God who does ordinary things, and how Jesus does it. He says, many of us treat people in our homes and people who are closest to us in a way we would never dare treat a stranger. But the Jesus of the scriptures is somebody who, even in these small moments, in these little towns, with this group of people, they were places and people for which nothing, the writer says, but his best was good enough. And then he says this: nearly everyone can do the big thing on the big occasion, but it takes Jesus to do the big thing on a simple, homely occasion like this. Here's what I take out of that. Every single person, what if we all lived our lives so that every day, every single person, like I know people who literally treat their spouse worse than they treat strangers. Do you know how messed up that is? They treat their homes more destructively than they would ever treat an acquaintance. Jesus ain't doing that. He's giving his best to the people closest to him. What if we lived our life in such a way where every single person we saw, every single person we interacted with on Facebook and Twitter and out in the street, Instagram, whatever, we treated them like they were infused with meaning and purpose and value and had the identity of being made in the image of God. We did the most for them. Nothing was below us. We wanted to bring our best to the table every time, no matter how small the occasion or the person. Rather than the big moments, we did the big thing in the small moments for the small people. What if that's how we lived our life? Listen to C.S. Lewis. In his sermon, The Weight of Glory, he says this: it is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest, most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature, heaven or hell, which if you saw it now, you'd be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as if you now meet only in a nightmare. All day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one of those destinations. And then he said, it is in light of these overwhelming possibilities that we should conduct all of our dealings with one another. All friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal, but it is immortals with whom we joke, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. Every person we interact with is of such value. There are no ordinary people. Every single person will live forever. Think about that. Every time you interact with someone, where are you leading them toward? To become an immortal horror or an everlasting splendor? How is your conversation with them helping them lead them toward the glory of God in Jesus Christ by the power of the Spirit and new creation versus away from him? It ain't going to be just by getting them to agree with your political stance. It ain't going to be by getting them to agree with your economic idea or whether they should do this or this with their, it's what, how are you helping them toward Jesus rather than away from him? Because you've never met an ordinary person. This is why racism is demonic and satanic. This is why the church is the place where in Revelation 5, it talks about how every tribe, tongue, and nation is worshiping the Lamb. Why the gospel is this global, transnational, the church is a people made up, because every single person, no matter the race, no matter the color, is made in the image of God. And to treat anybody, it's demonic to treat anybody as less value than made in the image of God and infused at their very essence with value and purpose and meaning. It's why every kid you interact with, you know, Jesus has this special spot where he talks about, you know, if you make one of these kids turn away from me, you might as well, you know, tie a millstone around your neck and throw yourself off a bridge. Because every kid, and what am I other than a 40-year-old kid? You wear the wounds of the things that happened to you in childhood all the time. Every kid you interact with is special, and you're helping, don't just ignore them, you're helping them toward one of those two ends. Every old person you meet, you're helping them toward one of those two ends. The point is, it was in Cana at a wedding with a bunch of people that didn't really mean much to the world stage. And that's where he chose to do this work that blessed this couple that no one's ever heard of. They're nameless. Says something, has this great phrase, verse 4. Jesus said to her, "Woman," I love this. He's got a toothpick. Mom comes up, "Do something, woman. Why are you, what does this have to do with me?" I love that. Now, kids, if you're watching this, don't say this to your parents. All right, don't be a woman, make me a grilled cheese sandwich. All right, that is not what this is. This phrase, actually, woman, we miss it in the English. It's the word gunai in the Greek, and it means like ma'am or like my lady. They used it in Homer, talked about it, Caesar Augustus in the Greek. They talked about it with women that they loved. So he's not being sassy. He's saying, "Yes, ma'am, my lady, what can I kind of do for you?" And then she says, you know, "Hey, look, they've run out of wine." And he says, "What does this have to do with me?" And literally kind of what he's saying is, "Don't worry, you don't understand quite how I'm going to do this. Leave it with me. I'm going to settle it on my own way," which is why she walks away and says, "Do whatever he tells you." He's not saying, "I'm not going to do anything." He's saying, "I'm going to do it," but in the Greek, it's kind of conveying this idea that I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. Just leave it with me. I'll deal with it, right? And that's why, you know, if he was saying what it sounds like he's saying, which is he's got the toothpick and he's hanging out and he says, "What does this have to do with me?" Meaning, "I'm not going to do anything. she would have gone and gone to the servants and gone, I don't know, he's hanging out with his boys playing video games, eating chips. He's useless. He's not going to help. But that's not what she says. She says, do whatever he tells you. Because he said, I'm going to deal with it. I'm just going to deal with it my own way. And then, and this is where we're going to end. And then he says this, my hour has not come. This is very haunting. And yet it might be it's definitely the most important part of these four or five verses. Imagine you're sitting around with your buddies and you're having dinner and you say, pass the barbecue sauce. And one of them goes, my hour has not come. You'd be like, what's this playa doing? What's wrong with this guy? There's something cryptic going on here. Put on your detective hat for a second. When you're reading the Bible and you come across something like that, especially when you're in like a one book, here's how to read the Gospel of John. I just want to equip you for a second. You read something like that and you say to yourself, what did he mean by this? My hour. And it's cryptic and you're like, I don't know. Here's what you need to do. There's lots of Bible tools you can do. Trace and chase down that phrase through the rest of the book, and you're gonna find out what he means. My hour has not yet come, woman, leave me alone. What do you mean, you have an hour? What's your hour? What's this big hour? What's the deal? So here's what happens. You chase down this phrase, my hour, through the Gospel of John, and here's what you find. John chapter 7, verse 30. At this, they tried to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. John chapter 12, Jesus replied, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. John chapter 12, verse 27, my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Verse 13, it was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. And then John 17, after Jesus said this, he looked toward heaven and said, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son. What's this hour? The hour is the moment of the cross. The hour is the greatest moment in history, the greatest moment of glory the universe has ever seen, when the cross. Here's what Jesus is trying to say and why this lands for us on the beautiful point of communion. Jesus is trying to say, listen to me, don't follow me because of my great religious teachings. There's lots of great religious teachers. You want to know what this is the end of religion, right? This isn't Buddhism. This isn't listening to the writings of the Quran. This isn't listening to the Hindu scriptures. This isn't even listening to principles given to you from the Old Testament, and now you should define your life by it. He's saying, you want to know what the center thing? It's not that primarily I'm a philosophical teacher giving you a new way to live. It's that I'm going to die. The cross is my hour, the hour of my great glory, and the hour in which I will accomplish the thing I came here to do. And now you've got to define your life by that event. And that event is the cross, the death of Jesus, where he took on the wrath of God. He shed his own blood and his body was broken so that he could forgive sin and bridge the gap. And so before we move in to the rest of this text, which we'll do next week, which has everything then flowing from chapter 5 and verse 5 and 6 to everything to do with you and me and what it means for our life, what it means for our joy, what it means for our purification, what it means for the religious way that we function in the world, and how Jesus is ending that and giving way to relationship and the way that we actually can experience transformation in our life versus just staying. He's going to deal with all of that. All of that's in the story next week. Right now he lands it and just says, listen, have you decided what you're going to do with what my hour was? The cross, the resurrection, the greatest moment of history. What are you going to do with it? So here, we're going to go to communion. And I want you to take the wine and take the cup and do communion. Chris and Kim are going to lead you in it in just a second as we worship together. But if you don't know Jesus, I want you to come before this question. What have you done with the hour? What have you done with the cross of Jesus. And if you do know him, now we participate in communion. It's one of the first times we've actually done it since COVID because we've been trying to figure out how to work it back. We've done it a few times, you in your home. But, you know, in the New Testament, they did it in their home all the time with their family. What a beautiful thing. Grab the kids. If they know Jesus, teach them about it. If they don't know Jesus, yeah, it's okay. If you don't know Jesus, you don't have to do it. But let the beauty, the confrontation of it, say, what have I done with this hour that Jesus seemed to think was the most important thing he was ever going to do? Wasn't his teachings. It was where it all went and what that cross and that hour actually accomplished and what do I do with that? So, Father, as we move into this time, let it be a time of actual worship and let it change some of us on the spots as we partake of your body and your blood, this hour that you came for, this thing that you pointed everyone toward, out of which everything we're going to talk about next week about actual on the ground life change, it all flows from here. This is how it actually, any of it gets accomplished, as we're going to talk about. So do that among us and let this be a sacred next few minutes with either by ourselves, with our family, with our friends, whoever we're doing this moment with. Let it be a sacred time. In your good name we pray.